of the kinds of signals and receptors that are involved in signaling. We actually drew this last time, but if you consider the signals and their respective receptors, that the signals fall into two classes, lipid-soluble and water-soluble. And the receptors for the lipid-soluble signals are all transcription factors, or virtually all, while the receptors for water-soluble signals fall into three categories. They are channels, tyrosine kinase receptors, and what are called G-protein-linked or G-protein-coupled receptors, G-protein-coupled receptors. Now, what we're going to talk about today are the lipid-soluble signals and their receptors, the transcription factors, and then we're going to talk about how water-soluble signals react with G-protein-coupled receptors to get some action. And the other two, we're going to leave for later. So I want to pick up with this part. How does a lipid-soluble signal, such as thyroid hormone or a steroid hormone, produce a result? Now, we talked about a lot of this last time, but to review, we said that these hormones are synthesized in cells which then release them automatically. These lipid-soluble signals cannot be stored because they move through membranes. So as soon as they're made, they are released. So they are released automatically and can't be stored. And that's in contrast to water-soluble signals, which are usually made in advance, packed into vesicles, and released when needed by exocytosis. But to go back to the lipid-soluble signals, so we mentioned last time that these lipid-soluble materials cannot travel through the blood unaided because they're not lipid, they're not water-soluble. So they usually travel through the blood bound to some protein. Now, a small amount of signal is in equilibrium with a small amount of free is always in equilibrium with the bound. A little bit always is falling off the protein carrier and going back on again. So the small amount of free signal is able to diffuse into the target cell. And bind inside the target cell to its receptor. And the receptor is a transcription factor. Now, the receptor is one of this class of what we've called regulatory transcription factors that all have a similar structure and function and belong to a single gene family. And so they always have, as we mentioned, two domains at least. They have a domain for binding to DNA, which binds to some specific sequence on the DNA. And this determines where this transcription factor will act. Because it determines in front of which genes it will bind. Now, if you have then a gene to be transcribed and make protein, in front of that gene on the 5' side, usually fairly close to the promoter, is a sequence which will be recognized by this DNA binding domain. If this transcription factor is going to affect transcription of this gene, then in front of that gene is this sequence, which is usually, if we're talking about a hormone, it's called a hormone response element. An element meaning a specific sequence. If you take this away, there'll no longer be a response to hormone. So this binds the hormone response element. Then once the transcription factor binds, it interacts with other proteins and either inhibits or activates transcription. And this is the domain that affects transcription. If it's an activating transcription factor, this is usually called the activating domain or the transacting domain. Now, if this is a transcription factor that responds to hormone, it has to have a hormone binding domain. So this has to be the hormone or signal binding domain. And when the hormone binds to this domain, that kicks the transcription factor into action. Beforehand, without hormone, this transcription factor lies around and does nothing. When the hormone is present, the transcription factor then binds to, if it isn't already there, the appropriate response element and either activates or inhibits transcription. Now, while we're at it, do we need some other domain in this protein? Do we need any other kind of signal that you can think of? If these things either wait around in the cytoplasm for the hormone, or they sit in the nucleus bound to the DNA, but they don't do anything until the hormone comes. So if they're in, does this need a signal peptide to get into the endomembrane system?
NLS.
Excuse me?
NLS.
Aha, it needs a nuclear localization signal, because sooner or later, this protein is going to be made in the cytoplasm, not in the ER, not attached to the ER. And sooner or later, it's going to have to go into the nucleus. So it also has to have somewhere a nuclear localization signal. Now, this may be masked until the hormone comes, in which case the protein sits in the cytoplasm, and the addition of hormone may uncover, change the shape of the protein, uncover the nuclear localization signal, and the protein will go to the nucleus. So what does happen when the hormone comes along? What kind of changes take place in the shape and function of these transcription factors? Well, usually in the absence of hormone, the transcription factor is bound to some sort of inhibitory protein. And so when the hormone comes along and binds, it bumps off the inhibitory protein. So the first thing that happens is the inhibitory protein leaves. Now you notice this is similar to a case we talked about before, where inhibiting an inhibitor, or getting rid of an inhibitor, triggers an activation. So in the absence of inhibitor now, the receptors generally dimerize. These proteins don't work if there's only one peptide chain. Two of these have to get together to form a complex in order to affect transcription. Now, the third step depends on where the transcription factor is. If the transcription factor is in the cytoplasm, it now changes shape by dimerizing and binding hormone, uncovers the nuclear localization signal, and moves to the nucleus. Now, of course, that's not necessary if it's already there. And some of them are already there. If it isn't already there, it binds. If it's already in the nucleus, it's already bound to DNA. But if it isn't, it now binds to DNA. If it was already on the DNA, it has changed shape so as to be able to work. If it was in the cytoplasm, it has moved to the nucleus, found the DNA, and is now in shape, ready to work. And so the final stage is that the transcription factor, which is bound now here by its DNA binding domain and dimerized, is now able to interact with other proteins and either activate or inhibit transcription. So we now affect transcription. It may go up and you make more of the corresponding protein, or it may go down and you stop making the corresponding protein. Now, what's an example of this kind of result? We mentioned the thyroid hormone works this way. But I don't want to get into the exact proteins affected by thyroid hormone. So instead, I want to talk about the case of estrogen. which is the female steroid hormone. Now, estrogen has many, many effects. It activates the transcription of some genes to make certain proteins and inhibits transcriptions of others. And many of the things which it affects are genes for receptors for other hormones. So a major act is to affect receptors for... Now, we should say it affects synthesis, because that's what it does. Estrogen binds to its receptor, and the receptor stimulates then transcription of genes and the synthesis of proteins, but the proteins that are made are receptors for other hormones. And to give an example of this, estrogen affects both the uterus and the breast during pregnancy. In the uterus, it causes the synthesis of oxytocin receptors. Oxytocin is another hormone which is involved also in multiple things. But one of the things oxytocin is involved in is promoting contractions of the uterus. So what happens here is that oxytocin receptors are, as they say, upregulated, meaning that estrogen causes transcription of the gene, causing you to make more proteins, put them in the right place, and now you have receptors for the hormone oxytocin. Now, how is this functional? At birth, oxytocin will be increased, and these receptors will be already, and that will trigger contractions and help expel the baby. So these receptors will be made in preparation for the production of the hormone needed to have birth. Now, on the other hand, in the breast, estrogen inhibits or downregulates another set of receptors. It inhibits transcription and synthesis of the appropriate receptor, downregulating the receptor, and these are the receptors for prolactin. Prolactin is the hormone responsible for the production of milk. Two different hormones are involved, one in the production of milk and one in the release of milk. But this is the one for the synthesis or production of milk. And these receptors are not made so that, because it's not time yet. Probably prolactin is around, but you don't want to respond to them. You don't want to respond to prolactin until after birth. So what happens is, during pregnancy, prolactin receptors are not made on the breast, and milk is not made. But as soon as birth occurs, estrogen goes down, inhibition is relieved, you start making prolactin receptors, you respond to prolactin, and you start making milk. So milk production is inhibited until the critical moment, while oxytocin receptors are prepared in advance for the critical moment. And this is fairly typical of the actions of estrogen. Now, how could estrogen, the same old hormone, with the same old receptor, have such different results or responses in these two different tissues? These two different cell types respond completely differently. Same hormone, same receptor. What's the difference? Well, let me ask it another way. Some tissues don't respond at all. Why not? What have they not got? They don't have receptors. Do they have the gene for the receptor? Yes. They have the gene for the receptor, because everything has the same genes, but the receptor gene is not transcribed. And so they don't make this protein, and they don't respond at all. But now, these two both make receptor. It binds hormone, it binds to the DNA. But it binds in different places because of other proteins that are already there. That it both binds in different places and has a different effect because of other proteins that are already present. There's a different set of proteins already in each of these. For example, the transcription factor receptor is the same in both of these. But there's another collection of transcription factors which is different in this cell from that one. The genes for the transcription factors are the same, but which ones have been used to make proteins are different. Another way of putting this is that the cis-acting factors, the regulatory regions on the DNA, are the same. But which ones are used are different, because the transacting factors that are made are different in these two sets. And Dr. Heitland will be talking in the next couple of days a little bit about how cells get different in the first place, so that there is one set of proteins made here and a different set made there. Now, I want to leave the lipid-soluble steroid-style hormones and talk now about water-soluble hormones. Before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions about this one. So in that case, we're going to move on. And we want to talk now about these G-protein coupled receptors. Now, I'm going to mention everything, I think, that's in the notes, but I'm not going to do it in exactly the same order. Approximately, but not quite. And I want to talk first just a little bit about these receptors and how the big scheme is. We explained last time that the big scheme is, if you have a G-protein coupled receptor on the surface of a cell, because these receptors have to be on the cell surface because the ligand cannot get inside the cell by itself. So if you have a surface receptor that is coupled to a G-protein, what happens is that when ligand binds to the receptor and you get a change in conformation, then this triggers activity of a G protein, which it triggers something else. And maybe it's just clearer to look at handout 12A at the top. Last time we drew this out a little differently, just as a series of arrows. But this shows you the basic picture, that this receptor that we're talking about, our receptor is embedded in the membrane, and the appropriate ligand binds, and that causes activation of a so-called G protein, which is also in the membrane. And then the G protein activates an enzyme, which then, in the cases we're talking about here, generates a so-called second messenger. Now, what I hope is clear from the picture is the relative positions of the first messenger, or the hormone or the ligand, and the second messenger, relative to the cell. So where is the first messenger? You notice it's on the outside of the cell. And if you look at your picture, where is the second messenger? It is inside the cell. Now, there are two panels here on your handout because there are two famous second messengers. And we're going to talk about both of them. And the difference is both, they activate different G proteins, which activate different enzymes, which generate different second messengers. We're going to talk about the top case first, where the second messenger is cyclic AMP, and then we'll come back and talk about the second one, where you get a different second messenger. Now, we want to talk about what G proteins are and how they work, but I wanted to say a word first about these receptors. And you notice that's a little later on. That all of the receptors that are coupled to G proteins, so-called G protein coupled receptors or G protein linked receptors, all belong to the same gene family, protein family. Here we go again. They're all similar in structure to each other. And they're all seven pass transmembrane proteins. Now, they are clearly distinguished in structure from the other major class of cell surface proteins. All the G protein coupled receptors are 7-fast proteins. All the TK, the tyrosine kinase receptors, are virtually all single peptides. So we aren't going to say anything else right now about the TK receptors, except that they differ majorly not only in function but in structure. And they belong to a different family of proteins. So if the receptor, a G protein coupled receptor, binds its ligand, then the effect is to bind to a G protein and activate the G protein. So the G protein goes from an inactive form to an active form, and its active form binds to and triggers the enzyme. Now I want to take a look at G proteins. It turns out that G proteins are involved in many other processes besides signaling, but we have ignored them up until now. And now we want to talk about G proteins and how they work. G proteins have two forms, active and inactive. So we'll start with inactive and active. And the big difference is GTP. The reason they're called G proteins is because it's GTP that activates them. Now, we've made many cases of ATP activating proteins. How did it do it? Well, it inactivates too. It doesn't do it directly. A kinase either adds a phosphate or takes off a phosphate, courtesy ATP. So a kinase alters a protein from one form to another by taking protein and adding phosphate from ATP. That's what a kinase does. A protein kinase adds the phosphate to proteins, other kinases add it to other things. And either the phosphorylated form or the unphosphorylated form can be the active version of the protein. Now, in the case of G proteins, on the other hand, the inactive form is bound to GDP, and the active form is bound to GTP. I want some colored chalk. Try this one. Now, how do you think you get from the inactive to the active? The obvious thing to do would be to add a phosphate on the GDP and turn it into GTP, but you don't. That's not how it works. The way it works is you start with a protein with GDP on it, and you bump the GDP off and replace it with GTP. So to make that clear, you add GTP. Unfortunately, I don't think this shows up too well. And the GDP falls off. And now the GTP replaces what was the GDP. So let's draw this. Now this is called GDP-GTP exchange. Because you have exchanged your old worn-out GDP for a new, fresh GTP. This is how you activate the protein. How do you inactivate it or get it back to where it used to be? This time you do the obvious. You simply knock the terminal phosphate off the triphosphate and it becomes a diphosphate. So the inactivation is just the loss of phosphate. Just as the inactivation here would be a phosphatase. Now, what is the net result of one cycle here? The net result of one cycle is you pick up a GTP and lose a GDP. And then later, you lose PI and go back to where you started. So the net effect is you've hydrolyzed one GTP. One GTP overall went in and out came one GDP and one inorganic phosphate. And for that reason, these enzymes are also called GTPases. These proteins, or G proteins, not enzymes, are called GTPases, which means they have enzymatic activity. And the net effect of activation and inactivation is the split GTP. But it's done by first exchange and then hydrolysis. Now, to go from inactive protein to active requires an enzyme, a kinase. To go from inactive to active here does not require a separate enzyme. The catalytic ability lies within the G protein itself. The G protein won't do anything until the active receptor sticks to it and changes its shape. But once it gets the signal or the kick, it itself catalyzes GTP-GDP exchange, and then, shortly thereafter, it itself catalyzes hydrolysis. Now, what's the point of picking up GTP if you're just going to hydrolyze it back to GDP again? One of the things about signals is you want to send a signal and then you want to turn it off. You don't want to leave it stuck in the on position. Now, by having what amounts to automatic return to start, by automatic inactivation, it means that whatever signal activates the exchange activity will be turned off in a short time, because the protein will activate itself and then shortly thereafter deactivate. Now, if it keeps getting more signal, more receptor hormone combination, then it will continue to activate, deactivate, activate, deactivate. But when there is no more input in the form of receptor, there is no more active G protein. Now, what does an active G protein do? It activates the next guy in line, which is usually, but not always, an enzyme. Now, how does it do that? Most G proteins, and most of those involved in signaling, are trimeric. That is, they have subunits. They have three. So a G protein has an alpha, a beta, and a gamma part. And it's the alpha that binds the GDP or the GTP. Now, when the active receptor binds to the G protein and kicks it into action, where do you add the GTP? Remember, it's an exchange. So we bump off the GDP and put GTP on instead. And when you add GTP, it makes the trimer fall apart. So you have the alpha part with GTP on it and the beta gamma part with nothing. Either of these halves can go and bind to and activate some other protein. Usually one or the other does the business. But sometimes, as you'll find out in some of the problems, or at last year's exam, I don't remember where it is, there are cases where both halves do something. One half activates one enzyme, the other half activates another. Now, what happens next? If this protein now is binding GTP, will the GTP stay for long? We've just said no, because the enzyme has its own GTPase. The enzyme has its own capacity to hydrolyze the GTP back to GDP. And when it's hydrolyzed back to GDP, the two halves come back together. Now, there are proteins that are called small G proteins, and they don't have subunits. Small G proteins are the same in that they have an inactive GDP-bound version and an active GTP version. Now, what's different is they can catalyze their own inactivation. So a small G protein has the catalytic ability to do this part. If you get it to the GTP form, it can get itself back to GDP. But it doesn't have the catalytic ability to catalyze exchange. So in order to activate it, you need another enzyme. The enzyme activity does not reside in the protein itself. So you need, for a small G protein, an additional enzyme to activate. Now, you don't need an enzyme to inactivate it, but there often are enzymes to speed up inactivation. Now, just for the record, probably the most famous small G protein is called RAS. And RAS is found in an abnormal mutated form in a very large number of cancers. So this appears to be a major player in regulating the cell cycle, and if you mess it up, you have a high probability of causing cancer or contributing to it. And we'll explain later, when we get to the cell cycle, how it fits in. What we are now concerned with is the next piece of the chain. If the receptor binds ligand, and that sticks to and activates the G protein, which then activates itself, if you have activated G protein, what does it then stimulate? It binds to and stimulates the next enzyme in line. Now, before I forget, there's more than one kind of G protein. Each receptor binds to and activates a particular G protein, and that determines what enzyme will get hit next, because different G proteins activate different enzymes. And what I didn't say, which is also important, is that some G proteins are inhibitory. So instead of activating the next guy in line, they inhibit it. Now, what we want to talk about is that first case on the top of your handout. How does the appropriate G protein, which is usually called G sub S for stimulatory, how does the appropriate G protein produce the second messenger, cyclic AMP? Which is short, and it's usually abbreviated AC. And this enzyme catalyzes the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP. Now, what is that? If you look down on the bottom of your handout, you see the actual structure. If it were ATP, we would have adenine, ribose, and then at the 5' position, we would have 3-phosphates. That's the substrate of adenyl cyclase. But what it does is to knock off 2 of those phosphates, and then to make a link between the 3' position, between the hydroxyl here, becomes linked to the remaining phosphate. And you can see the structure, it's written down there on the bottom of your handout, that you have a single, you have a CH2, and you have a phosphate here, and linked around to here. And this compound is used in many different contexts as a signaling molecule. In this context, though, its major function, and that's true in most of your cells, is it now is a small molecule which can diffuse through the cell, bind to and activate a primarily one target enzyme. And that target enzyme is protein kinase A, or PKA. Now, on your handout, it shows cyclic AMP and then two arrows to protein kinase. This does not mean two steps. This just means that the cyclic AMP can diffuse anywhere through the cell and find the PKA wherever it is. Protein kinase A by itself does nothing. It requires the binding of cyclic AMP to reach its active form. And the details of that are in your book if you're interested. But what we're interested in now is what happens next. Because let's go back again. Receptor, ligand binds to receptor. Activated receptor binds to and activates G protein. G protein catalyzes GTP-GDP exchange and becomes activated. Then it falls apart and the appropriate piece activates adenyl cyclase. Adenyl cyclase is an enzyme and catalyzes production of cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP goes through the cytoplasm and activates PKA. Now this part of the pathway is virtually all the same. But what happens next depends on what proteins are available in the cell to be phosphorylated by PKA. Now, before we forget, what about the length of the signal? Remember we said that when you do a signal, like epinephrine binds to the cell, do something, get with it. And the cell does it, and then you want to turn the signal off. When the epinephrine leaves, you want to turn the signal off. Now, how do you turn this off? If there's no more epinephrine and no more active receptor, then there's no more active G protein, and there's no more active enzyme, or the enzyme's inactive, and you don't make any more cyclic AMP. But what about the cyclic AMP that's already there? How do you get rid of it? Because if you're going to turn this signal off, you have to get rid of cyclic AMP. So we need one more piece in here, which is not on your handout. Actually, it's on the bottom. If you look on the very bottom, where it says ATP adenyl cyclase gives you cyclic AMP, and it draws the structure. And then it has something called PDE, and you get simply plain old AMP, adenosine monophosphate. This enzyme is phosphodiesterase. And it breaks this connection and turns this bizarre molecule back into ordinary AMP instead of the cyclic version. And that destroys the signal and shuts off the signal. So, when you get cyclic AMP, as long as it lasts, it can activate protein kinase A. But usually it is destroyed by phosphodiesterase so that it doesn't lie around too long. And regulation of signaling can include changing the levels of phosphodiesterase as well as so you can control both the production of cyclic AMP and the rate at which you get rid of cyclic AMP. Okay, but let's not lose sight of the main thing here. If you activate protein kinase A, while it is active, what does it do? And that depends on what proteins are around in the cell. We mentioned one example last time, that thyroid stimulating hormone works by this pathway. The thyroid stimulating hormone binds to receptors, stimulates the G protein, activates adenyl cyclase, causes production of cyclic AMP, and you make PKA. And then you phosphorylate all the proteins you need to make thyroid hormone. But I want to talk about a case in which we can actually list the enzymes. And that's on the other side of your handout on 12B. This is actually the first pathway to be understood as regulated by cyclic AMP and protein kinase A. Now, the top of your handout, all the way down to PKA, is just a repeat of what we have just said in a different form on the other side of the handout. That what we had said, except we have here a specific hormone instead of a generic one. The hormone epinephrine binds to a cell surface receptor, activates that receptor. That receptor binds a G protein. That activates adenyl cyclase. That generates production of cyclic AMP. And that activates protein kinase A, exactly as we had on the other side. Now, in liver cells and in muscle cells, what PKA does is to phosphorylate the proteins involved in the regulation of glycogen metabolism. If you look at the bottom of your handout, we have here the basics of glycogen metabolism. Glycogen is a storage form of glucose. It's a polymer. And it's stored in liver and skeletal muscle to be broken down and used for energy when you need it. Now, glycogen is synthesized from glucose 1-phosphate using additional ATP. I'm not going to go into the details. Using an enzyme called glycogen synthetase. So glycogen synthetase hooks the glucose monomers into a polymer for storage form. When you need energy, the glycogen is broken down into monomers, not into glucose, but glucose 1-phosphates, using an enzyme called phosphorylase. Now, what would happen if both of these two enzymes were active at once? You would have a short circuit, so to speak. What would happen is you would make glycogen and break it down and make glycogen, and you would be a futile cycle wasting ATP. So in fact, the system is set up so that one of the two enzymes is active at a time, never both of them. If you need energy, phosphorylase is active, you break down glycogen, and you can use the glucose for energy metabolism. If synthetase is active, then you can take extra glucose, polymerize it to glycogen, and save it for a rainy day. Now, how does cyclic AMP and PKA work in? When PKA is active, it phosphorylates two proteins, and this you need in the middle of your handout. And these are called phosphorylase kinase and glycogen synthetase. And phosphorylase kinase is a protein kinase that adds phosphate to phosphorylase. So the effect of having active PKA is to phosphorylate glycogen phosphorylase. So if you have active PKA, either directly or indirectly, you add phosphate to phosphorylase, and you add phosphate to the synthetase. But synthetase with a phosphate on it is inactive, while phosphorylase with a phosphate on it is active. Now you can see that from the symbols here. You see that this is a flat. This means inhibits. So PKA adds a phosphate to glycogen synthetase, but that just inactivates. It doesn't activate. It adds a phosphate to phosphorylase kinase, but we have an arrow here, so that means it activates. So an arrow is a shorthand for a plus effect, activation, stimulation, and a flat arrow for inhibition. And phosphorylase kinase phosphorylates the phosphorylase, which is, of course, now active. So what does this mean? If you have PKA, you have epinephrine, you make cyclic AMP, you activate PKA, you activate these enzymes, and you inhibit those. So that means you activate the enzyme on this side, but you inactivate or inhibit this enzyme. So the whole thing goes that way when the cyclic AMP is on. So what does that mean? if we have active phosphorylase, will break down glycogen and get glucose. Now, does this make any sense? Epinephrine is the famous stress hormone that you produce in response to a pop quiz, line in the street, and other stressors. Now, this means that in response to stress, you break down stored glycogen to glucose. And you can use the glucose now to get energy to run away from the lion, think for the quiz, whatever is necessary. So this makes sense functionally. But now, what happens when the pop quiz is over? Or they catch the lion and put him back in the zoo? So there's no more epinephrine, and that means that there's no more active G protein, and that means there's no more active adenyl cyclase. And what happens to the cyclic AMP? The phosphodiesterase destroys it, and so this whole thing is turned off, and pKa becomes inactive. On the other hand, if you look at the bottom down here, you see that when cyclic AMP is low, not only do you fail to activate protein kinase A, but you activate its antagonist, so to speak, a protein phosphatase. Now, why would you need a protein phosphatase? Here you've gone and phosphorylated all these enzymes. You've got to get those phosphates off. So you want to stop activating the enzyme. So when the cyclic AMP is low, you activate phosphatase. That takes the phosphate off glycogen synthetase. Now, is that inhibitory or activating? You don't have to think. Just look at the arrow. That's activating. What does it do to phosphorylase? That's inhibiting from this signal. So what happens when cyclic AMP is low is you do the reverse. When cyclic AMP is low, you activate a phosphatase instead of a kinase, and you take all the phosphates off. So you return synthetase to its active form, but you inactivate phosphorylase. So what's going to do to our pathway here? Low cyclic AMP, active synthetase. So now we're going to do the right half instead of the left. So after the epinephrine wears off, if you have extra glucose, you build it up into glycogen and save it for a rainy day. And you stop breaking down the stored glycogen it was for emergencies. Yep?
When the phosphatase removes the phosphate from the enzyme, does it do anything with that energy? Because a lot of times when we have phosphate switched off, it was like to...
The question is, what's the role of the, when you phosphorylate and dephosphorylate enzymes, the point of it, the energy of the ATP here is really being used to activate and inactivate enzymes as a regulatory device. It's not being used directly to run any kind of energy metabolism. And when you take off a phosphate, you do have a negative delta G. And that means that activation is going to be complete. This reaction is going to go strongly in the desired direction, and you're going to get the form you want. So here the energy of ATP and the energy of GTP for the G proteins is not being used to run a metabolic reaction, but to control the enzymes that run the metabolic reaction. Yeah?
Does GTP work all the time?
Does phosphodiesterase work all the time? I think it has a basal low level of activity, but I think that also is increased and decreased. But we're going to assume that phosphodiesterase is active most of the time, so that cyclic AMP doesn't last that long and has to be continually replenished. Yes?
What makes the epinephrine fall off the...
What makes the epinephrine fall off the receptor? Now, it depends for different hormones, but in this case, I think all that happens is that outside the cell in the blood or in the extracellular fluid, the concentration of epinephrine is quite low. So with time, if no new epinephrine is supplied, the epinephrine will diffuse away and fall off its receptor. However, in some cases, there are mechanisms for destroying either destroying the ligand or the ligand receptor combination, as with EGF. But here you don't do that. Yeah?
Do we know the time frame of this whole process?
I would think the time frame of this is minutes, but I don't know. You run pretty fast when the lion, you know, oh, the pop quiz, you think pretty fast. But I think it's quite quick. Because remember here, you're not making anything here. No transcription, no translation. You're not making anything near. What you're doing is changing the activity of what you already have. Now, cyclic AMP and phosphoprotein kinase A are used to regulate many, many different processes. And what I want to do now is talk about three different cases, two of which involve protein kinase A and one of them. Now, let me just say before I leave this, you're expected to know this part and how it works. But you're not expected to be able to figure out the rest of it without the pathway. Because each individual case involves a different pathway and a different set of arrows, and you have to figure out the consequences of that. But you're not expected to memorize this part or the equivalent part of any other example. Nourish the other cells so that when the lion comes, all of you, okay, let's stick to pop quizzes. When the pop quiz happens, all of your tissues get glucose, not just your liver and your muscles. In this case, of course, the main issue is the brain. Now, suppose when epinephrine is released from the adrenal gland, many different tissues respond, not just your liver and your muscle. We've already said that liver and skeletal muscle, because that's the kind it is, break down glycogen. Some types of smooth muscle relax. Some types of smooth muscle contract. So we'll call it smooth muscle A and B. Now we want to see why this makes sense, and then we're going to consider how these three different responses are possible in three different tissues to the same hormone. But before we do anything else, maybe we should ask, why does this pick? We understand the glycogen part. Now, which smooth muscle does what? Smooth muscle generally surrounds spaces and tubes in your body. And the one that relaxes is what surrounds the bronchioles, which are the small areas in the lung that contain air. So if they relax, if the bronchioles relax, it means the little air sacs are larger, and it means you can breathe in more, and you have more surface area for exchanging oxygen. So this allows you to get more oxygen in, thereby improving energy metabolism, therefore improving coping with the nasty situation. Okay. But why should any smooth muscle constrict? This smooth muscle surrounds the arterioles, or the very small arteries not everywhere, but in what's called the peripheral circulation. This means in your skin and your limbs. So if the tiny blood vessels in your arms contract, that pushes the blood away from your extremities towards your heart and your lungs and your brain, which at this point needed more. So this is a way of cutting off the circulation a little bit to the edges where you don't need it and pushing the blood into your the center of your body, into the major organs. And you can see why that also might make sense in response to a stress hormone. But now, how do you pull all of this off? It turns out that for the first, let's just call these 1, 2, and 3. For cases 1 and 2, we know that the same receptor and the same G protein are involved. So in both of these cases, same receptor, same hormone, same G protein, same enzyme, same second messenger, and same pKa. So in both of these cases, pKa is in fact activated. But in one cell type, the result is to break down glycogen, and another cell type, the result is to relax muscle. How is that possible? So I want you to think about that for about 30 seconds. How is that possible? In two different cell types as well. And the principle is actually the same. Anyone want to venture a thought? Well, there's some things I want to say, so I'm going to answer it myself, but otherwise I would call on you. That the big difference here is that the targets of pKa are different in these two different cells. These two cells, each cell type contains a different collection of proteins that can be activated or inactivated by pKa. We know that the liver and the skeletal muscle contain the enzymes for glycogen metabolism, and they can be turned up or down. They can be activated or inactivated. Those enzymes are not present in smooth muscle, which makes no glycogen at all, ever. But what is here are other proteins that are involved in contraction. And these proteins are affected by phosphorylation. Now, in your notes, it says that what happens is to activate a calcium pump. And that actually is what happens not in smooth muscle, but in heart muscle. Calcium is needed for contraction. Calcium up for contraction. In heart muscle, what pKa does is to phosphorylate and activate a pump so that calcium is removed from the cytoplasm. And if the calcium falls, the cell relaxes, the muscle relaxes. But it turns out that in this smooth muscle, the target is a little different. It is not a calcium pump, but it is another kinase, which is called myosin light chain. And that this kinase must be active in order for smooth muscle to contract, and pKa inactivates this kinase. I don't want to write all the details out now. Maybe we should write, though, what the basic idea is. But this protein, which we'll just call it just a kinase, has two forms, one with a phosphate and one without. And what pKa does is this one, of course. But this is inactive. So if there's no pKa, the MOCK, this kinase, responds to calcium and becomes active and causes contraction. But if you have pKa, that protein's inactive. So calcium doesn't make any difference anymore. calcium can't activate what doesn't work in the first place, and you get no contraction. So this one gives you contraction if the calcium is high. But this one gives you no contraction no matter what. So what's actually happening here is not manipulating the calcium, but manipulating the response to calcium. That what is happening is that in the presence of pKa, the calcium stays the same, but you can't contract anyway. Those details are not in the notes, but I'll put them in. Now, in both of these cases, the same hormone is triggering the production of cyclic AMP and activating protein kinase A, but there are different targets for protein kinase A, so you get a different result. But what about these two, cases 2 and 3? They're both smooth muscle. They both bind epinephrine, but one contracts and one relaxes. It turns out that these do not both work for cyclic AMP and protein kinase A. What's actually involved here is two different receptors for epinephrine. Epinephrine has, it turns out, multiple receptors. And it has two main classes that are called alpha and beta. These two responses use a beta receptor, and this response uses a kind of alpha receptor called alpha 1. Now, what's the difference? Remember we said that different there's more than one G protein? Different receptors bind to and activate different G proteins, which activate different enzymes, or inhibit them, which produce a different result. The beta receptors activate the G protein called GS, the one which stimulates the cyclic AMP pathway. But the alpha 1 receptor stimulates a different G protein, which stimulates a different enzyme. And that enzyme produces a different second messenger. And that's the second panel if you go back to your handout. You get cyclic AMP. But we've now discovered there are other possibilities. And now if you look at the second panel, in this case, when the ligand binds its receptor, you activate a different G protein. And it activates a different enzyme in the membrane. And this is not adenyl cyclase, but phospholipase C, known as PLC, but its whole name is written out on your handout. Now notice this is a lipase. So this is going to alter lipid, it's not going to alter ATP. And this alters one of the lipids in the membrane to generate two different second messengers. You see that we've written something called PIP2 here? And the action of PLC is to break it into two pieces known as IP3 and DAG. Now, to see what these things are, you have to look at the bottom of your handout again. This is one of the lipids in the membrane. It's a typical phospholipid. It has a glycerol and two fatty acids. And it has a phosphate here. This is the standard setup for phospholipids in the membrane. And what varies is what alcohol or group is here. And in this case, what is found here is inositol. Inositol is sort of like a sugar, except it has no carbonyl. It has only hydroxyls. This is a ring with 6 hydroxyls on it. That means that there are 6 different places you can put a phosphate on this thing. So it looks like this is a major signaling molecule because you can make the 1-phosphate version, the 2-phosphate version, the 3-phosphate version, the 3-phosphates with 1, 2, 3, and the 3-phosphates with 2, 4, 6. So variants of inositol appear to be big in signaling, but the details are just now working out for most of the other combinations. So we're going to stick to this particular one. Now, there's an enzyme in the cell that adds two more phosphates to this. And that gives you the next picture, which looks like this. And this is what is called PIP2 for phosphatidyl inositol, the basics, with two more phosphates on it. So it's PI, which is this part, which we had before with two more phosphates. It has many names. Some people call it phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate. But most people call it PIP2 for PI with two more phosphates. And that's what we mean, and that's one of the lipids in the membrane. Now, what happens when epinephrine binds to this receptor? It activates a G protein that binds, that activates itself, and then binds to PLC, it activates it, and then it splits PIP2 right here. So it knocks off the inositol with the three phosphates. And that's called IP3. That's what this is. And that's soluble and goes through the cytoplasm and acts as a second messenger. And its main job is one thing. You see in your picture there's a little bit of ER. And there are channels for calcium in the ER. The ER stores calcium. And what IP3 does is to open these channels so you can have a spurt of calcium into the cytoplasm. And it's actually the calcium that does the business. The calcium, some people call it the third messenger. Other people consider it another second messenger. It is actually the spike of calcium in the cytoplasm that does the dirty work. Now, before we consider the calcium, there's one more piece. This time we got two second messengers, not one. When we split this complicated molecule, we got the inositol with the three phosphates. We left the glycerol with the two fatty acids. And that's left in the membrane and is called diacylglycerol, and that's the other half. And just as the two halves of a G protein, either the alpha part or the beta-gamma part can trigger something. Either the IP3 can trigger something, or the diacylglycerol, or both. IP3 primarily causes release of calcium from the ER. And this compound DAG, the diacylglycerol, primarily activates one more kinase. You haven't heard the end of them, but this is the one, the last one for today. And this is a kinase which is sometimes in the membrane, sometimes in the cytoplasm. It's actually a family of kinases called protein kinase C. There's a protein kinase A, protein kinase B, and a protein kinase C. B is involved in some other complicated things, so we haven't been talking about it. A is the one that responds to cyclic AMP, and protein kinase C is the one that is activated by DAG. Possibly befitting its name, some of them also require calcium. In order to work, some don't. Now, this kinase, like every other kinase, can phosphorylate proteins and activate or inactivate them. The thing that's special here is the calcium business. That the calcium in the cytoplasm can act by itself to make proteins work better or worse. But very often, the calcium binds to a protein, which is written here on your handout, called calmodulin. And it is sometimes calcium alone that triggers action, but often it is calcium bound to calmodulin, the combo, that binds and acts as an activator or inhibitor. So let's see how this wraps up our final example here. How does using this IP3 business allow smooth muscle to contract? Do you remember that calcium triggers contraction? So what's happening here is that epinephrine is binding to its receptor. This is activating a G protein, which is activating phospholipase C, which is breaking down PIP2 to generate IP3. And IP3 is causing the release of calcium from the ER. And if you flood the cell with calcium, it will contract. So it is the release of calcium, courtesy IP3, that is happening in this cell. So what we're saying is that we have, in these two kinds of smooth muscle, different receptors on the surface. Some cells have beta-type receptors, some cells have alpha-type receptors. Depending on which type they have, when epinephrine comes along, either you generate cyclic AMP and the consequences, or you generate IP3 and the consequences. Now I want to say just one or two more words so you'll be able to do the problems. It turns out that a very large number, and anyone who has to go, please do. Many drugs interfere with the signaling. What a lot of them do is they bind to receptors. And they have one of two actions. Some drugs are mimics of the hormone. They bind the receptor and make the receptor trigger a response even when you wouldn't otherwise. And a drug that acts as a mimic is called an agonist. But some drugs are exactly the opposite. They, like an enzyme inhibitor, like a competitive inhibitor, they bind where the ligand goes, but they don't activate the receptor. They basically jam the receptor. They stick in where the ligand goes, but they don't activate. And those are called antagonists. And these are widely used, of course, in the research lab to try and figure out how these processes go. But they're also used a great deal in medicine to stimulate or block signaling pathways. For example, in asthma, you can't breathe. Now, from what we've said, would epinephrine help? Epinephrine will help because it relaxes the smooth muscles in your lungs and allows you to breathe better. Unfortunately, it also affects your heart. So what people have developed is an agonist or mimic of epinephrine, which only affects your lungs and not your heart, because they have slightly different receptors. An awful lot of drug development is trying to find an agonist that will affect only one kind and not the other. So we'll stop here, and next time Dr. Heitman will talk a bit about how this stuff develops.
Exam
covers all through this. I'll post it on the web. It does not cover tomorrow, Thursday, or next week. I have the regrades if you ask for one, I'll be ready to call it. Not last time.
This is kind of like, I don't know, I still feel like so inspiration for some reason. I never got it, I probably never will.
Yeah.
Like, this is kind of mixed, this is absolutely inspiring. Like, it's not so easy. It's just like, I don't know, it feels better. I'm so fast to the lectures, I have no idea what was going on in every single lecture. Like, every once in a while, I just don't know if it's just like, I'm a bit of a gem. Oh, man. Those six lectures are so good. Oh, man. That was that exam. I'm going to do that exam. It was the best I've ever done.
Yeah, I'm
Can you ask, are those injuries
constitution of the end and the muscles on the day before, like before is there. So I guess the epinephrine has to activate insulin so that muscles can.
No, epinephrine doesn't activate, as far as I know, doesn't activate insulin. The point of this is that you don't have to take up glucose in order to respond. You use the stored glycogen that you've already got. Turns out that exercise mobilizes GLUT4 as well as insulin. Not as well as insulin, but in addition to insulin. And that's one of the reasons that exercise probably helps diabetics and type 2s, that it helps, it produces some of the same effects. I don't think it's known how it does it. So this is independent of insulin, but those effects would be layered on top. One of the things we did not discuss here at all, which we'll talk about later, is that glucagon, which is anti-epin, anti-insulin, it's the hormone that counteracts insulin, does pretty much the same thing. So because insulin is when you have too much glucose in the blood, and you want to take it in, you want to make glycogen. Glucagon is when you haven't eaten in a long time, and you want to break down the glycogen slowly and run off it. So it has very similar.
And then if you haven't eaten in a long time, like all the muscles have, all the cells have enough ATP to like just plumb their baseline potassium bulk and everything.
You normally store enough glycogen in your muscles for, I think, like a couple of days. When you run a marathon, you run out. If you do ordinary activity, I think you have enough available to survive for quite a while. But I don't know exactly how long. You can go quite a long time without food. You can't go so long without water. But you can fast for some time before the glucose reserves everywhere give out. And then you can actually break down protein.
I just have a question. Where do you do PI to PI PIP2?
Well, the enzyme, this happens in the membrane.
But the PIP2 is in the
membrane. PIP2 is in the membrane, and I think the enzyme that modifies it is either in the membrane or it's right here.
Okay, so PLC
is... Because this is the... when we always draw lipids, we always draw lipids like this.
Expressions are always very good.
You know, there's phospholipids like that?
Yeah.
So this is the...
The head. Right.
The head end.
Right.
So it would be like this. So I don't... We're talking about modifying this part. And I don't know if the enzymes that you have here or they're basically like this one.
Okay, but PLC is only converting this reaction.
Yes.
Okay.
And
And I just had a question about with the HLA in the beginning. You said it's close to the core promoter. Is that
usually one of the so-called phospholipids?
But I thought regulatory proteins that transcription factors bind distally, and I thought only basal.
There's two parts. If you draw the core promoter here, there's also proximal regulatory elements and distal regulatory elements.
And
so the basal binds here.
Only the core promoter.
Yeah.
Not in the neurons.
No, but the regulatory binds are both of these. The two classes.
Okay. I thought
most of these bind here. I think some of them bind here, but most of them don't.
Okay.
That's why they're called regulatory elements and considered not to be part of the core promoter by most people.
Okay, because the core is just the basal.
This is the basal part, and this is the regulatory.
Okay. And last question was with the calcium in the muscle and the heart and the myocardium. Like, just from physiology, like with the in Sherwin or Sherwood, it wasn't. Doesn't. I mean, she was saying that the parasympathetic innervation causes it.
This is a little bit misleading because what this allows you to do is to relax between beats and therefore get a better beat. It doesn't make your heart beat slower.
Yeah, because it has to.
It doesn't make your heart beat slower. I think it increases the volume.
Right.
Because it
stroke volume.
So the reason I brought this up is that for many years I thought that this relaxation was because of activating a calcium pump in these cells. I read that somewhere once. And every year I think I'm going to look it up and look it up. And this year I finally looked it up and I discovered that this is not the explanation, but it's in the notes already.
What's the explanation?
That in the smooth muscle, it's not
when smooth muscle relaxes, it's not because you remove calcium from the cytoplasm in this case.
Okay.
What epinephrine does is not to remove calcium from the cytoplasm, but to reduce the response to calcium.
Because it phosphorylates the MLC.
Yeah, this actually binds to calcium calmodule.
Okay.
But if it's inactive, it can't.
Right, but okay, I just remember reading in that textbook that, like, you know, the plateau phase of the mitochondria. Like, what she was saying was that you cause the cell to the myocardium to increase, have more calcium come in during that phase, and that helps increase the stroke volume because the cells are able to track.
Yeah, I think so all this does is allow you to remove the calcium faster than you do another stroke.
I see. Okay.
Okay. This doesn't make your pump slower.
Okay.
This makes you pump faster, although it's not at all obvious. Okay. If you look, I looked it up in Boron, but it's the same idea. That calcium has multiple effects, and some of them look like they make you go faster, and some make you go slower.
Mm-hmm.
And because it depends which part of the cycle you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't make your heart relax.
It just puts by inactivating the kinase, or I mean,
but that's
by,
it.
This part is
in the smooth muscle.
So that's smooth muscle. Which
we're saying
is
in the smooth, this is what happens in smooth muscle.
Smooth muscle.
So we're saying in smooth muscle, this normally responds, this binds calcium calmodulin, mm-hmm. and that triggers contraction.
Mm-hmm.
If this isn't active, it doesn't matter what the calcium calmodulin, you can't do anything anyway.
Right. So you don't contract.
So you don't contract. So if you're in this stage, calcium schnalcium, you can't contract. If you're in this stage, it all depends on calcium.
When you're talking about smooth muscle, you're talking in the beta side.
Yeah.
But the heart is contracting harder.
But the heart, there's heart muscle and smooth muscle, and they respond differently to epinephrine. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, you're talking about smooth muscle in the,
the heart is smooth muscle. The heart is it's cardiac muscle. That's different.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
The only reason I put this in is because I screwed up the note. Or I wouldn't have brought the heart in at all. Because I wanted to make more sense.
What do you mean by primary, by target? I mean, the target protein, you know, I mean, you said primary target protein. But I thought the target protein was usually the enzyme at the end of the loop, not...
No, this is because what we're really talking about here is a protein kinase receptor, not a regular protein kinase. We're talking here not about a regular kinase, but a kinase receptor. No, I don't think that's
so. In that sense, the receptor is a target protein.
When you have a receptor, these kind, they kinase themselves. Okay, they add kinase. They add ATP. They add phosphates into the usually the other subunits of the same protein. So that's what that means. So in this context, it doesn't make sense. Thanks for pointing out, I have to change that because that doesn't make sense. For a regular kinase, a regular kinase usually targets another protein.
Right.
And I think I must have written that once when I was talking about TK receptors and I didn't realize that. Let me just change that.
Wait, if there's a competition between the pKa and the phosphatases, which is, you know, how do you turn the phosphatases off? Like when the pKa, so it doesn't mess up with...
Because the cyclic AMP affects differently the activation of the pKa and the kinase and the...
But you're affecting
the...
You're affecting the effects of phosphatases. You're not affecting phosphatases per se.
Yeah, you are. You're affecting
phosphatases. Yep. See you in a bit.
Sometimes they're jet lag too.
Well, that's what they recommend.
Yeah.
Like, if you go on the Columbia, Columbia College, major advising thing if you're like economics, it tells you like in bold letters, like take the econometrics like after you take it, right after you take them.
Yeah. But I hadn't taken micro and macro yet, so like.
Oh, you haven't?
No, I don't, but at that time.
Oh, okay.
So I took a junior
year.
Oh, yeah. So I wouldn't have been able to.
That makes sense.
But you, we don't even cover that much of that micro and macro.
Maybe there's more to come. I'm really afraid.
I don't really understand status that much. I'm really afraid that we haven't had to use it the whole yet.
The status?
Yeah. I went to the recitation for it, but still, like, I
just want to do regress, y, x. That's the scores are, and then plot, regress, or plot, y, half. That's like the point. I don't even know how to like enter into it.
What else are you taking?
I'm taking CC and Intro to Islamic Studies.
For Arabic cultures?
Yeah.
That's a lot of reading.
Yeah, it's pretty hefty.
Are you reading something for that?
Oh, no, that's for CC.
Marks. I really wish I took CC. I took major cultures. So I get a choice between major cultures, CC, and
I thought, you have to choose one of them three?
Yeah.
I thought it was just between CC and the prom.
No, major cultures. So I took major culture because it's easier, but then I feel like I would have gotten so much more out of CC. Like, if
CC, I like Vietnam a lot better. CC is so like philosophy like.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
I don't think I would have been able to handle that much reading though.
It's a lot of reading. I think it's probably more than Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, because major cultures, you can really, I didn't do much of the reading and I still did well.
You can BS it
so much.
Definitely. Sure.
Yeah.
Plus, it's not a small class. The hours are like really small classes, so like you have to read.
And you have to print it speed.
Yeah, and there's like assignments, like response with daily classes.
Yeah, it sucks. Are you taking just four classes?
Well, I was actually in the beginning, I usually took five, but the thing is I had to drop two in order to take my major cultures class.
Oh.
Because I have to study abroad and I have to take one major cultures before I go.
Why?
That's
too rude. There's so many major cultures, you can definitely fit something in after.
Obviously, yeah. It's like apparently you're supposed to have exposure to like a different culture before you go. I'm like, okay.
Oh, because the time was a time conflict with the other classes.
Yeah, it was. So I had to drop them. I was taking international relations and Arham. Mm-hmm.
You could get into a different Arham section.
I just sort of like gave up. And I was like, whatever.
Yeah.
Because I had a really good one, but then I had to drop them. I was like so upset. I'm like, that's it. Like, okay, I'll just take four classes, might as well.
How many credits do you need to graduate?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like less than C. It's only 128.
Oh, it's less than less. Yeah, 128?
Yeah.
That sounds about right. I have a lot of, I've taken five classes in my freshman year and my last semester sophomore. So, I'm not behind on credits or anything.
Right. I know some people that were econ poli sci that graduated in 3.5 years or 3 years. It's crazy. Like,
they also have done schedules.
Yeah, well, also they have a lot of AP credits.
Yeah, I have a couple, but they don't transfer into my major.
Which subject?
I think it's like you get credit. I got credit for my English and my one of the social studies ones, so like history.
Yeah, you have to get five. So you have four in U.S. history, it didn't count.
Yeah, I got five.
Good.
And then like my calc didn't count because I got a 5 and an AB going to BC calculus. So it doesn't count.
But they only count BC.
I think so, yeah, I guess you get a 5 in BC.
That's why I didn't take the BC calc exam because I was like, I'm not going to get a 5, whatever.
I mean, I got a 4, so
you should both?
Part
of it. You should both? AB.
Wait, in my high school it was like you take BC calculus and then you take the exam and then you actually get 2 grades. By taking the BC exam, you get your AB grade and your BC grade.
Oh.
That's like the two are like consolidated, like somehow.
Oh, is it the same test?
Yeah, it's all the same.
For AB and BC?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But like you take the actual AB, and then you have like in addition to that you have BC material like thrown all.
Oh, so if you were taking the AB class, you would just take a shorter test.
I think so. It's either shorter or it's just
different.
Well, yeah, it's definitely different, but. So I took BC, I'm like, might as well try.
Yeah.
Because technically you can get a 5 and AB and like go to 2 in BC. If you don't answer the BC questions.
Okay.
But you answer
did they tell you which ones are
the BC? No, they did not. But you kind of know because like, you know what the AP class teaches, like, first Olympics. And BC is, like, hard. It's a lot of, like, the geometric series and
right.
like, all that stuff.
I don't remember any of that stuff.
So I had to take calculus here when I came. Calc
yeah.
1 and 3, not 7.
Yeah, I took calc 2 and 3.
I didn't take two. I could have, but I was like, okay, since I don't need two to get into that major, I was like...
Do you need one?
Yeah. Well, you need one to take the three.
Okay.
You either need one or two. And I know the two is harder. So
really?
I might as well, yeah.
I thought two was pretty easy. But three I thought was ridiculously hard. I couldn't do it. Like, it's so bad.
I did, yeah. I had like an official BS teacher. Jorgensen, Charles Jorgensen. I didn't learn anything, but I mean...
You do well.
It was easy. I did well because I actually like had to study because like he taught us nothing and I was just like there's no way you could take the exam because you just don't know anything from the class. So I actually had to study for this.
Oh, because the only reason I did well in Calc 2 because I took BC Calc in high school,
mm-hmm.
so it was like the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then like Calc 3 was all new stuff. I could have like
yeah. Calc 3 is like three dimensional.
Yeah, a gradient and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
Like what? And like. For some of my classes in IUR, like, you need that stuff. That was a cool one. I don't remember. I sucked at it when I learned it. I suck at it now. I'm so glad I'm graduating. College is stressful.
Yeah, wow, you're senior, like you.
Yeah.
Are you going to, like, grad school?
I'm probably going to grad school after 2 years. I'm going to work at Prudential in New York, the headquarters. I'm going to be an investment analyst.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Wait, is it like it's for IB or?
No, it's not. It's for an insurance company.
Oh, yeah, Prudential.
Yeah, so it's like asset management. So it's on the buy side. I just learned yesterday what buy side means. I was talking to Yuki and he was like, was it buy side or sell side? I'm like, I don't know what that means. He's telling me. So, yeah, what do you want to do?
I mean, I'm interning now for IB sales and trading. I don't know, I guess going
which
to
company?
Like, oh, JP Morgan.
No, it's good.
See.
Why are you teaching poli sci too then?
Just like for personal reasons, just like to dilute my econometrics
yeah.
workload and all that sort of boring mathematical stuff.
Yeah, poli sci seems really interesting. It's a lot of reading too though.
That's true.
Where are you guys studying abroad?
Well, I just applied, so I'm waiting to find out. I'm going to London, University College London.
Okay.
So, like, just for a semester.
Are you going to do it in fall or something?
Yeah, this upcoming semester, so fall spring.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
How do you work housing for that?
I have no idea. I guess like I think I apply to the general lottery and then like I withdraw myself and then when I come back. I just have to be like
closed. Oh, that sucks. Yeah, I know someone that was a senior and she studied abroad in the fall of her senior year.
Uh-huh.
And she ended up in like Wayne.
That's
spring of her senior year. I was like, it sucks.
That does suck. But my friend, she's leaving spring semester 2008. So she's going to vacate the room and she's going to be single. So I can like request and like apply to get her room.
Is it
going to
be in a suite with friends or something?
Yeah, it's in the EC.
Okay.
I just really want to go. So like, I don't even care. If I come back to an awful room, I just want to go. But
yeah, I wish I could study abroad, because I couldn't fit it, because there's so many requirements, and like, some of my classes only offer certain semesters, so you, and like, they're pre-reqs and stuff, and like, the like, credits you get from study abroad wouldn't count toward anything.
Well, you wouldn't.
Like, it would, like, there's a certain class you have to take, and like, they don't offer other classes, like school. So.
Yeah, that's tough. I'm just like, I'm probably going to complete my econ requirements as well.
Okay.
If I go, I'm just going to take like, two more econ classes.
So you can get electives there.
Yeah, exactly.
Do the grades count?
Your grades don't go into your GPA, but if you apply to grad school, I think they request a transfer.
Okay.
So like, they don't count?
Count?
But they obviously would count.
Right.
Well,
would you go to grad school though?
I think so.
And after like working for a while.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. I wonder what you get at Columbia or Harvard. Yeah, but either you're at Columbia, because the extent you take sets, like, Columbia's the highest percentage of women in the business school, which is like, I think it's 35%, but the most business schools are 10%. So, and I also take more,
Columbia.
Different races,
too. Oh,
they take more Asians.
What about, does it work against you if you want to go on undergrad?
I don't know. I don't think it's
bad. I think you want to like, diversify if you don't want to.
Right. Well, I don't think it's bad as like PhD programs don't want to accept. Because I know a lot of friends are applying to PhDs and they don't want to accept Columbia people, so it's really hard. But I think business school looks different. Because I know someone who was Iowa and then last year he graduated and then he was applying. He was getting his master's in financial engineering and MBA at the same time. And he hasn't even worked yet.
Whoa.
He must have got like a stellar GPA. But I mean, he got it, so I figured like, they have some in my program. I figured like, it's okay. MIT has a good program, too. It's a lot more. I like a lot more math. I think I wanted to go to school with more math than most writing. So like, yeah.
This doesn't math block you.
What?
This doesn't math block you. Or you went to
yeah. Well, I mean, business school, like, finance is pretty hard, but like, it's not much, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, Harvard's, I got a case study, so. But the grades don't count. It's not the same book out there, but business
school. What do you mean grades don't count?
Like, well, like, the employer, like, they don't release grades to employers at Harvard and in Stanford and in Northwestern. But the Columbia Business School, they release the grades to the employers. So people, like, I've heard stories that people, like, tell other people, like, the wrong location to find all the stuff. They rip pages out of the book in the U.S. And, like, that's so ridiculous. So, I don't know. But it'd be nice to go to school that you're used to, you know?
I would try something new.
Yeah? Yeah. What do you think you want to go?
Important.
What?
Work.
They make you apply like a separate essay if you have less than 5 years of work experience. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why I looked at like, why I enjoyed this format. Yeah.
That's true.
It's kind of
hard. You played the best way.
Yeah.
You're not writing the truth, you just write the truth.
Yeah. I feel like you look up what they want to
hear. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like the unrestricted textbook or this textbook. Yeah. It's okay, but.
No, the kind of metrics are just all.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what our return would consist of.
Like proofs. Like, we should definitely like ask them for a cheat sheet. Because there's so many.
There's so many forms.
So many,
yeah. There's formula for like data one half.
Yeah.
Like data one plus and then like.
Oh,
sigmas, so all these sigmas.
There's so many formulas.
Econometrics?
Yeah.
I finished econometrics. The test is weird. It involves almost no math at all.
Really?
You essentially have to explain why the formulas work the way they do.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's hard. Who did you have?
Oh, I don't remember. Some guy.
I feel like teachers can test different ways.
That's true.
Because our teacher is teaching for the first time.
That's interesting.
We should totally pressure him into like doing a sample exam.
Or like at least a sample exam. The sample exam is just like, it's usually like almost the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. We have to pressure him. Like a lot of us have to come up to him.
No, because I emailed him, I was like, the class is really hard, you're going really fast. And he's like, no one else thinks that.
Are you serious?
I was like, okay. And I was like, your homework are all proofs, like, it's ridiculous. He's like, well, everybody got 20s, so it's like...
Yeah, because they bothered the hell out of their TA to explain to them.
So, like, he doesn't think any of us are struggling, so I feel like other people have to voice their opinions otherwise.
We should send them to ask email, like a petition.
Yeah.
I'm not looking forward to it.
looks like we're changing the slope. Like one above.
Thank you.
that?
Yeah.
pretty tough grades.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny.
Have the bond factor. I think these are more straightforward. questions?